Welcome to Tech Talk with Optimal Rx. My name is Kristen Gilmore. I'm here with Julianne Grant, and we are ready to talk herbal medicine.
Kristen and I are both practicing naturopaths with 25 years experience between us. As big herb nerds, we are excited to explore all things phytotherapy and health with you.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Talk with Optimal Rx. For the month of February, we are focused on all things skin. And to continue on with this theme, we feel very privileged today to have Dr. Julie Greenberg with us, who, besides chatting with us today, is also presenting two webinars for us in our Clinical Herbalism Skin series. There'll be one webinar on eczema and one on psoriasis. So for all the practitioners listening who have not yet registered for this series, this is one not to be missed. And to ensure that nobody misses out, the recording of the lectures and all the support material will be available after the live webinar as well. Now, for those of you who don't know Dr. Julie Greenberg, she is an absolute expert and wealth of knowledge when it comes to skin. Dr. Greenberg is a licensed naturopathic doctor and registered herbalist who specializes in functional dermatology. She is the founder of the Center of Integrative and Naturopathic Dermatology, Inc., a holistic clinic that approaches skin and hair problems by finding and treating the root cause. She is also the founder of rootcausedermatology.com, a medical education website that trains functional medicine practitioners on how to treat dermatological conditions using her cutting-edge approach. Dr. Greenberg holds degrees from Northwestern University, Stanford University, and Bastyr University, and her research on the gut microbiome of acne patients has been published and presented at multiple conferences. She also teaches dermatology classes at naturopathic medical schools and is a highly sought-after speaker at conferences across the US. And we are so lucky to have her here today speaking with us all the way in Melbourne, Australia. Welcome, Julie. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us.
Thank you guys so much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here.
And we feel so honored that you are here. But before Julianne and I dive into some of the burning questions that we have for you around eczema and psoriasis, could you firstly just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into integrative dermatology as your clinical focus?
Sure. Yeah. So as you said, I am a naturopathic doctor and I specialize in dermatology. I make that distinction. I'm not a conventional dermatologist. That's specific training. And they really do use, you know, mostly pharmaceuticals, which is not the naturopathic approach that naturopathic doctors, in case any of your listeners are not totally familiar, at least in the United States, we are licensed by state. So some states I'm a physician. And we really focus, there's a couple principles that guide our medical education and our practice. And that is that we say, first of all, treat the whole person. So in conventional medicine, we really like to chop up, you know, the body into different segments. And that can be helpful, you know, to have specialties, but we can't forget that it's all attached. It's all, the blood is circulating, you know, the skin is connected to the gut and everything else. So that's one principle. And, you know, the second is that we really try to find and treat the root cause. So pharmaceuticals, you know, are amazing and wonderful and have been life-saving. But for these chronic diseases that so much of the world suffers with, they're not going and treating the root cause. They're suppressing symptoms and actually then causing other symptoms. And you need to go on a second medication to suppress the the symptoms from the first one. And with naturopathic medicine, we're really trying to ask the question, wait, let's back up and ask, you know, why is the body malfunctioning? Why is it misfiring? Let's fix the problem. And then we don't need to keep suppressing the system. So that's really my, you know, foundation, my training and my practice and my approach to dermatology. In terms of like how I got here, I like to say it was a pretty naturopathic route to specialize in derm because it was actually through my thyroid. But again, all systems are connected. So I come from a business background, actually. As you mentioned, you know, I have my MBA from Stanford, and right after I graduated from business school, I was having some, you know, pretty classic symptoms, but it took a while to get diagnosed. I was fatigued, hair loss, weight gain, you know, all of the classic symptoms. Surprise, it was Hashimoto's hypothyroidism, which is an autoimmune disease. And when I went to, you know, the conventional hospital in Los Angeles, just a major hospital with all the resources. The endocrinologist said, well, yeah, you have this autoimmune disease. We don't know what causes it. We don't know how to fix it. You're going to have it your whole life. Probably you're going to be tired and overweight. And I walked out in my late 20s pretty shell-shocked from that experience. And that set me on this course of, medicine. I started researching. I was like, that just can't be right. How is that the answer? And I just had a voracious appetite for researching health, and it got me into researching nutrition and what we were eating and what our, the things that we're eating and how crazy that all is. And then I learned about all the topicals that we're putting on our skin and all the endocrine disruptors that are in them. And every year the number kind of goes up, but now they say that on average, every woman puts about 150 chemicals on her skin a day through personal care products. And at first, that sounds astounding, like, how could that be? But if you go home and you turn over a lot of your personal care products, your shampoo, your conditioner, your lotion, your deodorant, your mascaras, all of the things that you toothpaste and mouthwash and things that you use on a daily basis, unless you're proactively using, healthy, clean products, there's probably 20 to 30 multisyllabic chemical sounding names in each of your products. And you can really easily get to over 150 chemicals. And then I learned about that connection between what we're putting on our skin and the thyroid. And that really set me on the course. And then I became so passionate about it that I decided to go back to school for 4 years of, actually, it was more than 4 years of medical school. Naturopathic medical school is 4 years, but I was an economics major in undergrad. So I had to go do all the college science pre-med prerequisites and then go to naturopathic medical school. So I was very dedicated. But that is, yes, the long answer of how I got to naturopathic medicine. And it really just became this love of dermatology. And it's really, I think, an amazing practice. I don't know, and probably in Australia, but in America, can you guess what the number one disease in America is?
No, it could be any autoimmune disease I would be thinking.
It's actually acne. So over 50 million
Okay.
Americans have acne. Yeah. And probably in Australia, you guys have a fair number. And now, it used to be something we would think of as like, oh, that's a teenage disease, which it still is, a lot of teens, but so many adults have it. So many adults have adult onset acne. And when something is on somebody's skin, whether it's acne, psoriasis, eczema, especially when it's on the face or hands or things where they're presenting to people, it really, really impacts their life. And it's really meaningful work to clean it up and give them their lives back in many cases. So I'm biased, but I just really love specializing in dermatology.
We're very pleased that you are specializing in dermatology and we have you here today speaking about it. And honestly, for me, it never gets old listening to practitioners and their path towards natural medicine and how that happened. And I know for both Kristen and myself, we both have our own personal stories around that too and what landed us. And it came later in life for me as also after doing another Bachelor of Science. So it's a great story and I thank you for sharing it because it also comes across the passion that you have for supporting skin health and therefore overall health and well-being in the patients that you see. And in doing the research for the upcoming webinars, we do some create some support material for our practitioners that register for it. One of the things I found so astounding, and I shouldn't, but I did find so astounding, was the statistics around mental illnesses or their feeling of health and wellness when there is that skin presentation. So it's a really valuable point you make. And as practitioners, we can holistically do a lot around that, to support their mood and well-being going forward too. It's a great point
Yeah,
to share.
absolutely.
Yeah. And as we mentioned, I'm not sure if we did mention, but I will now, that you'll be speaking for us both on eczema and on psoriasis. So we're super excited about that. And I really would love to hear from your clinical perspective and the experience that you have. Can you kind of describe the typical presentation of both? So, what would a typical eczema patient present with, and what would a typical psoriasis patient present with?
Yeah, and that's a great question because I have a lot of patients who come in and they say, I have eczema and psoriasis or eczema or psoriasis, and they
Yeah.
don't know. And they're really two very separate diseases in terms of the pathophysiology, what is actually going wrong in the body, and also the presentation. So I guess let's start with eczema. So eczema The classic spots, if you kind of look in the dermatology books, it's the flexural surfaces. So the inside of the elbows, behind the knees, this would be like on adults, that's where we're going to see it. But I also see patients a lot of times on the neck and chest. So you can have eczema anywhere for sure. But the classic, like if you look in the dermatology books, it's going to be inside like the antecubital fossa and behind the knees, the popliteal fossas. With infants and pediatric patients, it's a little bit different. With infants, most of the time it's going to start on the cheeks. There's a reason for this. We used to not understand why do babies have, eczema on their cheeks, but then older people don't. I won't give away the spoiler alert. If you come to the lecture, I'm going to really show you why this is. So it's really exciting, I think. One of the great things about derm too is because of this, it happens in certain places. And when we figure out why, I think it's really exciting. So I won't do a spoiler alert on that. But so in pediatrics, you're going to see it on the cheeks. A lot of times, like on the dorsum of the feet. So like the ankles, also the flexural, like where they kind of bend the ankles, the tops of the feet. There's a lot of hand eczema in pediatric and adult. But those are kind of the typical things that we're going to see. And eczema is what we call a Th2 mediated disease. So we have a lot of different types of immune cells and immune pathways because we have to fight a lot of different things. And we it's just like, I liken it in when I'm explaining it to patients, and you'll see this also in the lecture. It's kind of like our armed forces. So whether it's Australian or American, we have an army that is a land-based force with tanks. We have an air force that's going to obviously go up and fight things in the air. We have a navy to fight by sea. We have different types of armed forces to fight different things, and so does the body. So this Th2 pathway I'm talking about with eczema, this is the allergic pathway, things like mast cells and histamine and eosinophils. And that's why we call eczema an atopic disease, an allergic disease, because there are these allergies. And eczema is part of the atopic triad or allergic triad, where we see asthma and food allergies. Those three, that they tend to come in three. And also, if you come to the lecture, I'm going to explain why this is. And a lot of people think, well, the food is, the food and the food allergies are driving eczema. There's going to be a big surprise in the lecture because we've learned a lot about it. But yeah, so it's this whole allergic type disease, and we get these rashes. And really, there's I think maybe we'll talk about it a little bit later, but there's microbes on the skin. And for eczema, the thing on the skin that we're really battling most of the time is a bacteria called Staph aureus. There can also be yeast called Malassezia, but Staph aureus is really kind of the main enemy to the eczema patient. So that's the eczema side. Now, if we turn our attention over to psoriasis, what is that going to look like on a patient? Well, it's the opposite. So we said that eczema is going to be in those flexural surfaces, so the inside of the elbow and behind the knee. Psoriasis is the opposite. It's on the extensor surfaces. So it's going to be on the outside of the elbow and the top of the kneecaps. That's where we're going to see things. And these we really see more plaques. Plaques are really the buildup of skin because part of the pathophysiology of psoriasis is an overproliferation of keratinocytes. Keratinocytes are skin cells, and they start kind of growing like crazy. And so they build up these thick plaques that are like red and have silver scaling. That's on a white or Caucasian patient. On a skin of color patient, they are going to really just a lot of times look more white or silvery. You're not going to see as much erythema or redness. Same for eczema as well. But you're going to see them again on the elbows and on the knees. Those are again the classic plaque psoriasis places. But you also see them everywhere, a lot of times on the back, and that is a different, it's kind of a, it's called guttate psoriasis, and it's known as like a teardrop or more spotty psoriasis. But a lot of times these guttate psoriasis will coalesce and then start forming plaques. So it's really kind of blending. But a lot of times on the back, it can be on the stomach, it can be on the legs, it can be on the arms, it can be on the face, the genitals, the belly button. I mean, you can have psoriasis anywhere too. But again, for the big kind of like, if you're looking in a derm book or you're looking at a patient, the easiest way is it inside the elbow and behind the knee? That is much more likely to be eczema. Is it on the outside of the elbow and the kneecaps? That is much more likely to be psoriasis. And psoriasis, instead of being a TH2 pathway, which we talked about for eczema, there's no TH2 pathway at all in psoriasis. It is mostly a TH17 and partially a TH1 driven disease. And that is kind of more of an autoimmune type of presentation. And psoriasis kind of rides this line between is it or isn't it autoimmune, but it kind of is. And so it's these different pathways with the TH17 and the TH1. And you're going to learn in the lectures, right? You need to approach these completely differently. These are not the same diseases at all. And there's certain herbs that we know are great at fighting TH17 pathways and others that are going to be better at like TH2. So we really need to know the correct diagnosis. What does our patient have? And then how are we going to go about it by treating that underlying pathophysiology? And again, for me, it's using herbs and supplements and natural things, not suppressing it. In the conventional world, you'll see inhibitors. So for eczema, you have the TH2 inhibitors like dupilumab. That's the injection they get. And it's a system-wide suppression that's going to push down their entire TH2 pathway. They can have all sorts of problems with that. With psoriasis, it's mostly now the TH17 focused inhibitors. And that's going to suppress their immune system and cause it a whole other host of problems. So, obviously, we are not talking about inhibiting them. We're talking about what's driving the TH2, what's driving the TH17. Let's clean that up using natural things and restore function to the body. And that's what I'll be talking about.
That's a great distinction between the two conditions. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. And I think because sometimes we do get patients walking through our clinic doors that actually don't have diagnoses, but we'll show you, we'll share photographs with you, et cetera. So it's really great advice and some really clear tips on how we can perhaps start differentiating it. And I'm really looking forward to the cheek eczema explanation come your webinar. I can't wait for that one. And when we're researching these, and as naturopaths, we dive in and we research the condition base that our patients are presenting with. And we can see with both of those conditions that even speaking on an etiological level, that they're multifactorial. There's many reasons perhaps why this is now presenting with this particular patient. But in your experience or even in your mind, are you able to just briefly touch on what you believe are the main drivers of perhaps eczema or the main drivers of psoriasis, depending how much time you want to give us with this one?
Yeah, so I do my whole methodology for treating is that I look and at the gut. So I do a stool test and an organic acid test on every patient. I'm analyzing the gut microbiome and the dysbiosis occurring, and I'm fixing that from the inside out. That's driving a lot of the inflammation. And then from the outside in, I'm addressing the stuff on the skin. So just if we're going to kind of make generalizations with eczema, my patients tend to have a completely leaky gut. They are, there's a thick mucosal barrier throughout our entire digestive tract. And the purpose of that mucosal barrier is to allow certain things into our bloodstream, like nutrients from food, right? That's the whole purpose of our whole GI tract from mouth to anus, is we bring in food, we have to digest it, extract nutrients, and then get rid of waste. So we want those nutrients to be able to get into the bloodstream and out to every cell in the body. But we don't want microbes or toxins or other things getting through into the bloodstream. And the mucosal barrier is it's almost like a bouncer at the door, right? Being determining, okay, you're small, you're a nutrient, you get through. No, you're a big bad bacteria, you don't get to get through. My eczema patients really have a leaky gut, and we'll get into that in the talk, like how do I assess for that? There's lots of ways to kind of assess for leaky gut, but they're usually missing some commensal keystone bacteria like Akkermansia muciniphila and Faecalibacterium prysnitzii, by and large. So I think it's the leaky gut. And in the talk, we'll also talk about leaky skin and the similarities between leaky gut and leaky skin, and what happens when you have that, how it drives that allergic, atopic response. And then again, on the skin or really battling Staph aureus, mostly. So those, it's the leaky gut inside and then Staph aureus on the skin if we're really going to simplify it for eczema. For psoriasis, I would say the pathogen there, strep, is the number one most known environmental trigger. I can't tell you how many of my older psoriasis patients had their tonsils removed because it just was like recurrent strep throats. So that's very common in older psoriasis patients. And so it's not strep so much on the skin, but it's internal strep at the mucosal surfaces. And something that fires, the Th17 pathway is pathogens at mucosal surfaces. Well, our nasopharynx, our tonsils, that's all mucosal surface. Our gut is mucosal surface. So I see a lot of pathogens in the gut. Things like Pseudomonas comes up a lot in my psoriasis patients. So when, basically the whole mouth to anus, again, whether it's the nasopharynx, or the actual gut, if we have pathogens, it's the strep kind of colonizing the tonsils and then overgrowth of pathogens in the gut that really tends to drive that Th17 process in psoriasis. So right, the Th17 pathway is also fungal. So there's something called Malassezia yeast, which is on all of us. And a lot of my psoriasis patients have kind of an overbloom of Malassezia on their skin. And so treating with antifungal, certainly with all scalp psoriasis, 100% it's a fungal Malassezia overgrowth, but sometimes also on the body, if we wash with kind of more natural antifungal options, it can really help the skin on the body as well. So yeah, more fungal strep problems for psoriasis and really pathogens at mucosal surfaces.
And that's all just so fascinating because, as you spoke to kind of earlier, that inside out and that outside in, I guess, approach, it just means that that holistic picture and all those drivers are dealt with really succinctly. And I know, I mean, I have psoriasis personally, and I deal with a lot of skin patients, and infections are such a common trigger for flares of psoriasis. For eczema as well, but I just, that strep throat that you were talking about, that recurrent tonsillitis, even other respiratory infections, sinus infections, they really can just, sort of have this pattern of that recurrent flare where they think they've got everything under control, and then the immune system gets that kind of kick and they feel like they've taken 20 steps backwards. So that's really, really interesting. And you mentioned that you do some of that functional testing with your patients. And Juliana and myself both do a bit of microbiome mapping and some organic acid testing and things like that. Do you tend to, for your skin patients, what would you say would be the perhaps the order of testing that you would do and the most useful tests? And are there any commonalities or differences that you would see perhaps with something like an organic acid test between these patient categories?
Yeah, so I'm usually booked out several months in advance, and so patients are required before they see me for the first visit to do a GI MAP stool test, and then they do an organic acid test. So those are both ready at every first patient visit. I review them with them. They've taken a course from me, so they understand these kind of concepts. My patients are very smart, and really do research themselves and want to understand this. And it is understandable. Like, you don't have to be a doctor to understand some of these basic concepts. So I review it with them. So everybody's going to get, the stool and the oat test to start. Then, based on what's happening, either clinically or kind of what the labs are showing, I may go on and do other testing. So there's a hormone test called the Dutch that I use. That can be helpful for seeing for adrenal, a picture of the adrenals with the cortisol, like with my TSW, topical steroid withdrawal patients, is very helpful to look at their adrenals. But looking at hormones is helpful for a lot of things. So sometimes I will do the Dutch. I do a lot of mold and mycotoxin treatment because there's a lot of mold and mycotoxin illness. So if there's a lot of, mold or water damage or, certain things on the oat, then I'll probably run a mycotoxin on them and then be treating, that as well. So I would say those are kind of the main tests that I do. Once if it's, if I'm suspicious of like Lyme or, co-infections or something like that, that's not really my wheelhouse, so I would refer out for other kinds of, testing or treatment if it's getting much beyond that. But another thing that comes up a lot is dental hygiene, like dental disease, cavitations, like below root canals. So if that is seeming likely, then I will have them go to a biologic dentist and try to assess what's going on and clean that up. And it's amazing when that's the problem, how quickly things can resolve because it's a mucosal surface and it's causing a lot of trouble, below the surface with dental disease and gum disease and stuff like that as well.
Yeah, the mold is very interesting too, isn't it, Julie? Like, are you seeing an increase in that in your practice? I know we are over here, but I'm not sure if
Yeah,
it's
I
a
mean, I see so much of it, and people, are like, oh, well, I live in the desert, or I live, I mean, so I'm licensed in California, Oregon, and Washington. Oregon and Washington, for the Australians who aren't familiar with U.S. Geography, they're what we call the Pacific Northwest, and it's very wet, and it's like a rainforest, and it's so that's somewhere where you think like, oh, okay, that makes sense that they're mold. But I have a lot of patients in Los Angeles, let's say, for example, and I think that weather is similar to like Sydney or something. It's not a wet, moist environment, but mold is everywhere. And a lot of people will say, well, but the house is new, so I don't have mold. But then the question is, well, what do we build homes out of? We build it out of dead trees. What is the food for mold? Dead trees. And that lumber that went into building the new home was sitting out in a lumber yard somewhere, at some point getting rained on. And if there was mold, then unfortunately, the mold can be built into the new home. So no one is really safe. And yeah, I mean, I see it so much. And it's really a bummer when it comes up because if they're an owner, inspecting mold and remediating mold is such a financial sinkhole. It's like the Alice down the rabbit hole. You just don't know where it's going to stop and how much it's going to cost. But when there are mycotoxins in mold and you have sick patients, you have to get them out or get it remediated because they just won't get better. And I see this a lot, particularly in my autoimmune patients. I treat a lot of alopecia areata, which is, of course, an autoimmune attack on the hair follicle. And so many times it really is that. And as soon as we start to like clean it up and get patients out of that environment, the hair will come back and it makes just a world of difference. So.
Yeah, the turnaround once they're out of that environment does make a world of difference as long as they're getting the right support along the way. But it's such almost such a traumatic healing experience because they're actually diving into many things that cause people stress, jobs, money, family health and wellness, all of these sorts of things. So it's often tricky. So that's really interesting that it does come up quite a bit in your practice, particularly around autoimmunity, which makes complete sense.
Yeah.
But our love, obviously, here is all around herbal medicine and the use of phytomedicines in our clinics. And we would love to just maybe tweak your brain a little bit and grab some information out of your brain regarding herbal medicine, particularly what you tend to reach for with regards to the areas of treatment with your patients, with your skin patients. What are the kind of key herbal medicines or the key areas of herbal medicine that you're actually reaching for? Is it sort of is it stress response? Is it sleep support? Is it immune activity? What do you tend to really work with the herbal medicines for?
Yeah, so I would say my main focus is antimicrobials. So antibacterial, antifungal, antiprotozoal. I'm not treating as much antiviral, but if there's something coming up recurrent, then I will. But I would say antibacterial, antifungal, and then underneath that antiprotozoal, because there's so much dysfunction in the gut that the dysbiosis really is the driver. And in order to restore function, most of the time there's overgrowth of, dysbiotic or unwanted bacteria, fungal organisms, and things like protozoa that needs to get cleaned up. And then we need to support the rebuilding of the gut. So the antimicrobial world is definitely where I'm playing. There are other things, both on the skin and in the gut, I would say. There's certainly things like for, eczema patients, there will be the, mast cell inhibitor formulas, things like a stinging nettle or, vitamin C and quercetin and all that kind of stuff to try to calm the allergic response. But that's still really in the realm of symptom management until we get rid of the drivers of that, like the protozoa in there or the fungal or, the candida or whatever. We're still playing with symptom management. So for me, it's the antimicrobial world that I'm mostly playing in. And I will give sleep support formulas and all that. But again, like in eczema, once the itch stops, they're sleeping through the night. So it's like all of the other stuff I think of as more supportive, even adrenal support and all that. What I like about the microbial formula is I feel like it's really addressing that root cause and cleaning things up.
Definitely. And we love our herbal antimicrobials, and they're so potent. I find the symptomatology, relieving some symptoms, gives us the space to work a little bit deeper in working with those root causes, doesn't it? Even if that's making lifestyle changes, giving them a little bit better sleep or a little bit more room to move in their stress response, it just allows them to do a little bit more of the treatment plans we're asking. So they can be
For sure.
powerful there. Yeah. So I'd love to know, if we're talking topical herbs, do you have a handful or one or two topical herbs that you tend to reach for often in your practice for either condition? Either condition.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it depends. I mean, I'm a huge fan of essential oils, not in pediatrics as much, but in my adult populations. I don't make like my own formulas, either oral or topical, so I tend to use things that are out there. With essential oils, I always, talk to patients about the fact that they shouldn't be mixing and creating and doing their own essential oils unless they are herbalists, because it's very easy to get into trouble with essential oils. You don't I don't think people realize that they can be, kind of dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. You can get sensitized, you can get photo burn, phototoxic burns and other things as well. But they are, really great antimicrobials. So they work great on the skin, and you just want like a trusted brand and blend where an herbalist, a formulator, has put together things in a reasonable manner. I like hydrosols as well, like rosemary hydrosol is really great. It's antifungal and antibacterial. That works really well in both eczema and psoriasis patients. I'm a huge fan of hydrosols, and that's totally usable in a pediatric population, no problem. Aloe. If the skin is really compromised, like some eczema patients are in such a state that it's going to burn them, and you got to wait until the skin is a little more repaired before you can put something like aloe on, but it's a great, herbal topical. Yeah, I mean, there's the skin soothers like, calendula and chamomile and all that, but you've also got to be a little careful with eczema because they're atopic and allergic, and those are in the Asteraceae kind of ragweed family, so they could, actually have a reaction to it. So, sometimes it's being a little careful, but I do love essential oils when used responsibly and properly on, more adult population.
You make such a good point too, because I think sometimes in our enthusiasm and excitement to try and, oh, I know this is good for this, or let's chuck some of this on and see if it helps. There are so many other things to consider, not just about the indication. We've got to think about the pH of the skin and what level their skin barrier function is at the time, and all sorts of things as to the delivery system of that ingredient. So I think that's really important. And also, thinking about something like the scalp, that might be an area that's really quite difficult to get to with a topical treatment, because,
That one you need to use, yeah. So I have like alopecia totalis and universalis patients who there's just nothing on the scalp, and then you can put, all sorts of oils with like rosemary essential oil and things that are going to increase blood flow and stimulate all that. But most of the time, if it's just dandruff, like a seborrheic dermatitis of the scalp, or even diffuse hair loss, you're not going to be able to use that kind of stuff. You have to go for shampoos. So yeah, for me with like a seborrheic dermatitis presentation, I like some zinc pyrithione shampoos. It's a very strong, very good antifungal. It's harder to get, like, you're not going to get a salve or a balm on the scalp because it's just going to muck up the hair and it's not really feasible. But hydrosols work well on the hair, so I do have patients do that. They can kind of part their hair and spray the rosemary on, and it smells beautiful. It's, mostly kind of like a tea, and it dries clear, so there's not going to be any effect on their hairstyle or hair. So I do really like hydrosols sprays on the scalp.
That is an excellent, excellent tip. And as someone who spent many years of my childhood putting many lotions and oils and tars and things on my scalp, trying to, get some relief and washing your hair what felt like 10 times a day, something like that can really make a huge, huge difference. And topical relief can't be underestimated either. So really good information.
Yeah, I just remembered one other tip for topicals. I call I supercharge the shampoo or conditioner with essential oil. So I have them put the shampoo and conditioner in their hand, add like a couple drops of rosemary or tea tree essential oil, mix it into their shampoo or conditioner, massage it in, give themselves a little scalp massage, leave it in for a few minutes, and then wash it out. We're only getting, a couple minutes touch point, but when you add in some, responsible essential oils, it can be super helpful.
Oh yeah, and you're really individualizing that treatment as well for that patient, which is
Yeah, we should say this is not medical advice for anybody. We're just having a general discussion, so.
exactly. And there's a lot of I know we've released a lot of information in previous lectures and different podcasts and things about safely manufacturing different types of topicals, creams and shampoos and gels and things like that that you can contact us if you want more information on. So talking about that sort of topical, those topical sort of treatments that you love, do you have any favorite herbal medicines that you can't live without that you sort of reach for consistently internally for patients with either condition? I know, especially, I guess, if you've got those different kind of common profiles of infections.
Yeah, I'm really treating what I'm seeing. I mean, I for internal stuff, I mean, I feel like I'm a classic naturopathic doctor. I love all the berberines and a little bit of garlic, oregano. For psoriasis, you'll see in my talk, Scutellaria bicalensis is a really great one internally. It's got a Th17 inhibition pathway and Indigo naturalis topically, so I'll talk more about that. But I just yeah, I'm trying to think. I do love like clove and rosemary internally as well. I tend to use a lot of blends. I think we do get 1 + 1 = 3 when we do herbal formulations and stuff. If it's a pediatric eczema patient, I might start one single dosing to see how they're tolerating things. But then, as I have confidence that somebody can tolerate the herbs, I do love blends. I would say neem. Neem is one of my very favorites, both orally and topically. I just love it. So, yeah, maybe those are kind of a few that, they're, I mean, I'm just using them all the time, so.
And they're amazing options. And I think something that is really that I really love and appreciate about what you've just said is that you've mentioned a few herbs that have potentially perhaps been pigeonholed in a different area that people wouldn't automatically think of for skin, like Scutellaria bakulensis, basal skull cap. I think that, as it was taught a lot in Australian naturopathic school, it's quite specifically known as an anti-allergy herb, and I think it actually has such a beautiful broad range across many systems in the body, including the immune, like you mentioned, respiratory, cardiovascular, even the nervous system. So I really appreciate you giving it some airtime, and I'm really looking forward to, hearing more about it in your lecture because it just seems so specifically indicated for a condition like psoriasis where, I think traditionally we've kind of stuck with depuratives and not really gone too far into other specific treatments with herbal medicine. So it's very, very, very exciting. And neem as well, topically, I think is just fantastic. I remember having a very significant case when I was at school of scabies, a patient coming in with scabies and I sort of was like, okay, well, what about this and what about that? And the neem really just made this incredible difference to this patient. And I thought, oh, I have to remember that. So,
Yeah, I mean, probably every patient of mine ends up on neem orally at some point too. I really love it orally. It's a great antifungal. I mean, it's broad spectrum like they all are, but it's a great antifungal.
yeah, so good to know. I'm sure practitioners are taking lots of notes with this podcast too. So, just continuing on with that sort of treatment line of thinking, we've sort of mentioned as well, oftentimes the journey to healing with skin conditions can be quite difficult, because, we might have symptoms like being insanely itchy or it might be painful or, there is this big psychosocial burden that can, the aesthetics can cause emotional distress and it can be quite a difficult journey to becoming well. And we know that these particular conditions as well can often be relapsing because of their different drivers and triggers. So when you're dealing with, say, a moderate to severe case of eczema and then compared with psoriasis, what kind of timeline of treatment would you sort of expect to follow? I know it would be different individually as well, but how do you sort of talk to your patients about what to expect?
I mean, everybody wants to, what's the timeline? And the truth is, I just never know. I mean, sometimes it moves really fast and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes we've made very quick progress and then we hit a snag, like they get COVID. As Julianne said, as soon as somebody gets ill, the immune system is ramping up to go fight that. And we can see flares of conditions, with pediatric eczema, if they're teething, their cheeks, their cheek eczema is going to become inflamed because it's an inflamed area, right, with teeth breaking through the surface. So I never know what the runway is going to look like. The conversation I do have with every patient is your skin is going to clear before the gut is totally fixed. And I talk to my patients about this kind of proverbial bucket, right? We all have this bucket, and bad things are filling up in the bucket. So if you live in, the US, like in LA, there's a lot of smog and traffic, and those are toxins, and that's going into our bucket. If somebody is smoking or drinking too much, if, our water now, it's hard to get clean water. So all these things are filling up our bucket and adding to the body burden. And once that bucket overflows, that's where we start to see problems like, oh, I'm having eczema, I'm having psoriasis or alopecia areata or whatever the problem is. So I tell them, I'm trying to find the things that are filling up your bucket, like the gut dysbiosis, and I'm trying to lower that bucket. So when I lower the bucket, when I lower the water in the bucket to below the lid and it's no longer overflowing, we're going to see the skin clear up. But I tell them we probably are still riding the fine line at the top. And if we just stop, I made the mistake early on. I would think, oh, look, the skin is clear. We did it. We did it. We're done, and I would just immediately be like, okay, I guess we're done. And then I would see them coming back on my schedule, 4 months, 6 months down the line. And I realized through retesting and stuff, I was like, oh, we lowered the water in the bucket, but we were kind of hovering at the top. So now I talk to them about like we really want to drain that down. And all of it is also I'm educating them on how to maintain this going forward. We don't get user manuals, but they know really well throughout the process, like they learn what's kind of triggering things. And so even if the skin is clear, I'm often still treating them. And honestly, they don't care. They're just so happy that the skin is finally clear. That they are like, yes, like let's do all work. I don't want this to come back. And so I can never really tell how long, the timeline is going to be. You'll see, I'm going to be doing case studies in my talks. I think those are always the most effective. So you'll see like a presentation, this is so and so. Here's what their eczema or their psoriasis looks like, at the first visit. And then you're going to see from visit to visit how their skin changes. So those will be, a couple of examples, but it is different for every person. And we never know. I mean, somebody could, with psoriasis, could get exposed to strep throat from somebody. That's going to cause their psoriasis to go bonkers. So we just never know.
Often these health things are a lifelong journey anyway, aren't they? Once they've been established, you get their little flares, but it's about how long we can stay well for. I think that I love that bucket analogy. I'm actually going to use that, but not just skin. I think
I don't know where it was. I'm not the originator of it, but
that
yes, it's a good analogy.
really good. I'm a visual learner, so I really like those sorts of things for being able to talk to patients about. I think that's brilliant. Julie, you mentioned earlier about your patients when they do ring up to book in with you that they get to see a video and do sorts of things that are about their education of what they're having work done for. So whether that's psoriasis or eczema, is that information on your website for practitioners and other people in Australia to be able to look into, or do they need to contact you? What's the best way to get more information about you and what you offer?
Yeah, so there's my clinic site, but again, I'm only licensed in California, Oregon, and Washington in the United States, and I only see patients who live in one of those three states. For practitioners or people who don't live in those three states, then my other site, Root Cause Dermatology, would be more useful. In Root Cause Dermatology, I have some courses for like lay people for patients. Those are the courses that my patients take before. And it is really just breaking down the pathophysiology and what's driving the disease. I'm not giving treatment plans or treatment recommendations in it, but it's really to decode for people. People spend hours searching the internet, like, why is this happening? Why can't I clean my baby's eczema? Why have I had psoriasis for 30 years? And so these videos, these courses really break down that information for them. For practitioners, for medical professionals, Rukaz Dermatology has some medical courses. And there's a 4-month intensive cohort for licensed healthcare practitioners. So if you're licensed in your country, I guess it would work. And then there's also going to be a self-paced course for non-licensed healthcare practitioners, but practitioners who are still able to order, herbs and run functional medicine labs and stuff like that. So that's on rootcausedermatology.com.
That's a wealth of information, and I'm sure that a lot of our listeners will be jumping onto those websites and have a look. Julie, we want to thank you so much for spending time with us today, but also for your upcoming webinars, which we are really excited by. And just today is just a touch on it. I know I've already got my list of questions in the Q&A part of those of those webinars, but we want to thank you so much for joining us today. And we really do look forward to the two webinars that you're presenting on eczema and psoriasis. Is there anything you want to say to those people out there that are either practicing in this space or suffering from one of these conditions as a little bit of hope or guidance before you leave us today?
Yeah, I mean, there really is so much information out there. And, for the integrative practitioners, we are just working hard to put the pieces together. We learn more and more. I have, many healthcare practitioners have taken my course, many board certified dermatologists. So I've been encouraged to see that even conventional dermatologists and conventional medical professionals, they have seen the beauty in functional and naturopathic and herbal medicine. And they come to learn and they want to practice it because it really is getting to the root cause. And there really are, practitioners out there who can help you. So don't give up. I know so many eczema patients are so tired of, going to dermatologist after dermatologist and getting tubes of steroids, but there are other options out there. So, you really can, put this stuff into remission and live a healthy, happy life. So.
Fantastic. Thanks again, Julie. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.